Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking about the various British setbacks during the Desert War in 1942, building up to Britain's final roll of the dice at El Alamein at the end of 1942, early 1943. So if you've listened to previous podcasts on the Desert War, you'll know that the Desert War, in terms of the overall outcome of the Second World War, is something of a sideshow. But the British were determined, particularly Churchill, was determined to pursue it, firstly because it was the only opportunity to try to score a decisive victory over Germany, following the withdrawal of the British Expeditionary Force from Dunkirk. But also it was a means of protecting the oil of the Middle East, protecting the Suez Canal and the arterial route from Britain to its Asian empire, and also of establishing a foothold at the kind of the periphery of the Axis empire. And the way that Churchill saw the war from a traditionally British perspective was that taking on the Nazi empire head-on would be all but impossible, and waging war at the periphery was the way to do it until America and the Soviet Union were ready to land the heaviest of blows. The way that the Desert War was fought was, fortunately for the British, a series of almost never-ending missed opportunities. The British had an excellent model to learn from in the German example. Most of the RAF, most of the best aircraft, remained in Britain, and so it gave the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, during 1941 particularly, a brief kind of edge, a minor aerial advantage over the Desert Air Force in the Western Desert. But the real problem was the fact that even though the British and Commonwealth forces outnumbered the Germans and Italians, the Germans and Italians were, the Germans were better organised, led, and their armour was far superior to the British. The way in which each division of the German army in the Afrika Korps worked, each battalion of the Afrika Korps worked, was an example to modern armies during the Second World War and thereafter, each battalion was complete with anti-aircraft guns, tanks, its own air support, field workshops, and artillery. So there was a complete synchronisation of infantry, armour, aircraft and artillery. And the fact that Britain's generals didn't see this until quite late on in the war as being extremely important tells you something about the calibre of generals that Britain really had during the conflict. I mean, one theory that is often put forward is that the First World War had culled off the British Army's finest minds, and that those that survived were kind of secondary calibre. This may or may not be true. Certainly, if you look at Gary Sheffield, he argues that actually the First World War was a bloody learning curve for the British Army, and learning new techniques, mastering new technologies, and integrating forces into a kind of a synchronicity of men, artillery, armour and aircraft was one of the defining features of Britain's victory. So, you know, it's debatable, that one. But certainly there seemed to be precious little innovation on the battlefield in 1941 to 1942. German tanks, as I've mentioned, were superior to British tanks, and their ability to quickly repair them was far superior to Britain's. The prospect of mechanical failure on the battlefield was more serious, really, even than losing tanks to enemy action. But of course, the British faced the deadly threat of the 88mm cannon, which could destroy tanks from a significant distance away, far out of range of the guns of Britain's tanks. The systems for recovering broken down tanks and repairing them was poor and ineffectual. And the army that the British put into the field, led by Cunningham, we've already discussed his excellent work really previously, was not really able to match the ability of Germany to integrate tank, anti-tank guns and infantry together. The British, in essence, exposed their tanks unsupported by anti-tank guns, and therefore had a disastrous time throughout much of 1941. In Operation Crusader, that we mentioned very briefly in the podcast on Iraq and Syria, the 7th Armoured Brigade started with 141 tanks and lost 113 of them. Whilst this was an unimaginable catastrophe, it still didn't prompt the British to really do anything particularly different in the desert for a considerable time to come. This obviously has a knock-on effect on the morale of British soldiers in the desert, knowing that they were poorly led and led by inflexible and unimaginative soldiers. Despite the fairly micro nature of the war, Britain's 8th Army that fought in the desert has gone on to occupy an enormous space in British popular culture and the British imagination, and it certainly did so during the Second World War. The contribution to overall victory, whilst significant in North Africa, as we've said, dwarfed by other campaigns. But it was the only evidence that the British had that positive things were happening in the desert, and this was a kind of underdog story as well, the kind of story that most powerful imperialist nations tend to come out with. But the idea was that the desert rats were the plucky battlers against Hitler's sinister legions, and their improvisation and pluck and good spirit and chirpiness and all that sort of thing would come through. The way in which Rommel was seen, though, in point of fact, was not entirely negative. He was admired by the British soldiers. He was referred to as... the German army was referred to as Rommel. And the nickname of the Desert Fox meant that he actually had some grudging admiration amongst the British general public too. One has to recall that Rommel was indeed a supporter of Hitler, and only changed his tune on this subject in 1944, and becomes very peripherally involved in the plot against Hitler, and is forced to commit suicide as a result. One of the things that the British always did master, and Britain's secret weapon, was intelligence, and really the ultra intercepts at Bletchley Park, where the Enigma code was broken and the most important intelligence of the war was gathered. This was a vital part of the victory over Germany, particularly in North Africa, because it gave information on the supply lines, particularly to Rommel, and how shipping was moving in the Mediterranean to resupply the Africa Corps. And it was rather unfortunate, therefore, that this information was leaked to the Germans, however unintentionally, by Bonner Fellers, who was the US military attaché in Cairo. So Rommel was able to stay one step ahead of the British, just at the same time that the British were able to spy on German activities, all the way up to July 1942, when Fellers was recalled to Washington. The source of the leak was uncovered. Fellers was not engaged in any sort of treacherous espionage. It was more an example of what happens when intelligence is insecure. So the other aspect of the war that seems to be wildly at odds with the Russian front was the intensity of and brutality of the combat. Obviously, there was fighting, there were casualties, men were killed, but there seems to have been an ability to retain some degree of humanity. On both sides, prisoners appear to be relatively well treated. There was a kind of a general sense amongst the Allies that the Germans were not monsters and didn't do things like execute prisoners, as they certainly did do on the Russian front. This is, of course, due to the fact that on the Russian front, a racial war of annihilation was being fought, and there was no such reason to fight such a conflict in North Africa. Of course.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This results in the in either side being perhaps slightly more willing to surrender in hopeless conditions, both knowing that the firing squad or the Labour camp is not going to be their fate. However, as the Africa Corps marched on Alexandria, it was mooted that it would be a good idea to reinstitute the old First World War penalty of executions for desertion or cowardice. Churchill quickly countermanded this, and knowing that it would be absolutely unthinkable amongst the British public and amongst the British Army to start doing this kind of thing. It's always important not to see this as a British endeavour either. Not only were there Australian and New Zealand forces fighting in the desert, but also South African, Polish, French soldiers, Indian soldiers, and a smattering of other Allied troops from across occupied Europe and Britain's empire. And it seems to be have been the consensus amongst the German and even British officers that it was the Australians who stood out as the best and most determined fighters of the Desert War. Perhaps one reason for Britain's great tank failings during the Desert War was that the armoured regiments and the armoured division had been, their ancestry had been in Britain's cavalry divisions. Obviously the horse had been made obsolete as a result of the First World War. Though that said, vast numbers of horses were used in the Second World War. But for the British, the new steed that rode into battle was the tank. And the mentality of the all-out cavalry charge that had won at Waterloo still stayed with the traditions of the British cavalry divisions, now armoured divisions, and to their great folly, really. Well, the Germans synchronised anti-tank operations and artillery and infantry and armour together, the all-out tank charge into a killing ground had predictable and endless disasters until the traditions that guided the British and the memories of glorious cavalry charges were finally laid to rest. And if the British soldier thought that his life was being put on the line by effete aristocrats that had no understanding of the value of human life, human working class life, then certainly Britain's colonial troops felt that far more acutely. Troops from Australia and New Zealand and troops from India, who had been part of the mainstay of Britain's army in the Middle East and North Africa in the First World War as well, felt deeply that they were not valued, even though they did some of the hardest fighting, and that their lives were cheap. When the plans put forth by British officers seemed to be ill-conceived and poorly executed, and men died as a result, this only brought about deeper resentment. Particularly in the case of Australia and New Zealand, many of the post-war tensions between Britain and the Antipodes and the kind of the general cooling of relations between the mother country and Australia and New Zealand were partly due to memories of the way in which the diggers or the Anzacs in general were treated. And this resentment is also kind of echoes failures of Gallipoli and the disaster of the fall of Singapore, which we'll come to at some point in the near future. Cairo had become the centre of British operations, but also the centre of British military social life, with bars, brothels, and everything the soldier might require on leave. But it was also a great hiding place for officers who couldn't cut it in the desert, and a hiding place for men who were rotated out of the front line and who were taking more than their fair share of leave. But there was a popular feeling amongst frontline troops in the desert that the lazier end of the British officer corps, the more craven end of the British officer corps, were having a gay old time in Cairo and managing to duck their duty. How true this is impossible to say, but there's certainly a kernel of truth to this accusation, particularly as it looked as if Egypt might fall to the Africa Corps and the situation became hopeless. Retreating to a hedonistic lifestyle away from the front line became more and more appealing. Of course, keeping the Eighth Army going in a desert country thousands of miles away from Great Britain is difficult, and it requires support staff and it requires bureaucrats and planners. But Churchill suspected that there was a top-heavy management infrastructure in Cairo and few officers or fewer officers getting their hands dirty with the real fighting. The war itself, compared to fighting in, say, the Pacific or Burma or Russia, was relatively, I say relatively, more comfortable. The only real issue was water and the constant gripe of the tank crews, flies. British soldiers became acquainted with desert terrain very quickly. They began to understand where quicksand or sand drifts might be and how easy it was for lorries and jeeps to get bogged down in the dust. Looking for rough, pebbly terrain was far better. Accounts of the war suggest that the soldiers' experience was 90% boredom and 10% terror. Most of the time was spent in the baking heat, trying to remain active or trying to stave off boredom. Books were in short supply, and a soldier with a novel or a Penguin classic would be very highly sought after, and he's got traded around. And I suppose in part the tedium of war in the desert perhaps accounts for the occasional camaraderie between both sides and the chivalrous attitudes that we've talked about previously. In January 1942, Rommel launched a very effective offensive against the British Army, who tried to defend against this thrust at the improvised Gazala line, where brigades were built into boxes, huge areas of land protected by barbed wire, mines and defensive positions. The plan was to force Rommel to dissipate his force by attacking these positions, and the problem of this was that he didn't understand that Germans were a master of flanking operations, and the boxes were too far apart to support one another, so the Germans could bypass them. The hardest fought battle was by the Free French Brigade, who fought at Bir Hakeim, but even the French were forced eventually to withdraw. The Gazala offensive began on the 26th of May, and within 4 days the Germans had gained the advantage. The British were forced to retreat, and a combined South African and Indian force was left to hold on to Tobruk, and the 8th Army fell back into Egypt. Rommel decided wisely to bypass Tobruk. He could lay siege to it at a later date. And the city eventually fell on the 20th of June due to the poor defences that had been not been kind of maintained to a sufficiently high level, falling into disrepair. And the fall of Tobruk really shows about how overstretched the British and their Commonwealth forces were in North Africa. And this apocryphal story, not an apocryphal story, an actual story, is that when Churchill was visiting Roosevelt in the White House at the time, and the telex of the fall of Tobruk came through, and Churchill wept, apparently. He said, "Defeat is one thing, disgrace is another." And the fall of Tobruk led to 30,000 Allied prisoners falling into German hands. And after Tobruk, the road seemed open to Cairo. The disaster of the first half of 1942 can't be understated. The Germans had lost 3,360 men, the British 50,000, mostly as prisoners. And much of Britain's armour had been lost. While Churchill was in Washington, Roosevelt simply asked him, "What can America do? What can I do to help?" And the answer was tanks, and lots of them. And it would be this flow of armour to the Middle East and to the North British holding the line in Egypt that would finally provide Britain with the answer and give them the springboard they needed to launch the operations at El Alamein and smash Rommel's hold over North Africa. It was these kinds of defeats, the fall of Tobruk, the fall of Singapore, and Britain's rather average showing during the war, that would have huge implications for Britain after the war, and Britain's claims to be a world power at the top tier of global affairs was going to come under intense pressure. So much so that by the time of the later war conferences, Britain had been reduced in stature as one of the big three to being the half in what Churchill referred to as the big two and a half. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Please pop by the Explaining History Facebook page and say hi. I've got some interesting questions for everyone there, stuff we want to do for 2018. So, you know, come and be involved. It'd be great to hear from you all. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.